Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Artist First World Radio Network, home of the best new music you've never heard, and home of the best new talk shows you need to hear. Please don't forget to visit our archives page at www.artistfirst.com, where you can hear all our past shows for free and on demand. You are tuning in to Unique, Life Starring You. The show usually airs on Mondays at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but today we're doing a special broadcast on Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For more information about this show and to listen to past shows for free, please visit artistfirst.com/younique.htm. And now here is your host of Unique Life Starring You, Susan Stackpole.
Thank you so much, Corey, and thank you, listeners, for joining us here on YO Unique Life Starring You. It's all about you and for you, and we are what we are because of you. So thank you for joining us. We have a special project here at Unique called Pray It Forward. And basically what that is that we believe that sending love and prayers and kind intentions out into the world makes a difference. And there's a lot of disconcerting news in the media. So we ask that when you see that you just send some loving thoughts their way. And studies show it does improve the situation. We have an extra special guest with us this evening, and he's even had a movie made about him, and his name is Dr. Patch Adams, and Dr. Adams is both a medical doctor and a clown, and he is also a social activist who has devoted 30 years to changing America's healthcare system. He explores the relationship between humor and therapy using his unique blend of knowledge, showmanship, and hands-on teaching techniques in working with health and mental health professionals. Pat says, I interpret my experiences in life as being happy. I want, as a doctor, to say it does matter to your health to be happy. It may be the most important health factor in your life. Dr. Adams is nationally known as a speaker on wellness, laughter, and humor, as well as on healthcare and healthcare systems. He approaches the issues of personal community and global health with zestful exuberance, according to Time magazine. He believes that the most revolutionary act one can commit in our world is to be happy, and here to share more about that with us is Dr. Patch Adams himself. Welcome to the program, Patch.
Thank you for having me. I know you read something my agent gave you, and so I want to correct. I'm actually in the 42nd year of this work.
Oh, excellent.
So I usually ask people not to read some canned statement, but I understand we didn't clarify that beforehand.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you clarified that for us, Patch. Thank you so much.
And it actually is internationally.
Internationally. All right. Awesome. Well, congratulations. And it just shows, too, how much you continue to grow, which is excellent. And that's what you want. You want yes, and you want up, and you want progress. And it sounds like that's what you've had.
I also want political action.
We're going to talk a little bit about that tonight, Patch. I love that you have such passionate views and such well-informed views on what you feel like we can do to help change our healthcare system today. To get started, we may have some listeners who may not be familiar with you and the work that you're doing, and so we just ask you to share with us a little bit about what was the exact turning point for you, where you became so passionate about changing the healthcare system in America?
Well, I'm not specifically about changing the healthcare system. My father died from war when I was 16 in 1961. I'd grown up overseas on military bases. We moved back to the United States, to the South in 1961, and I realized my country was a fake and that Christianity was a fake, because the black population had no civil rights. They couldn't even use a drinking fountain or a toilet of a white person. And my initial reaction was horror. I wept for the lies and misrepresentation I'd gotten in my schools and realized that the adult world actually didn't care. If people saw the movie, it starts with me in a mental hospital. I had three hospitalizations in 1 year over 17 and 18 because I was trying to kill myself. I didn't want to live in a world of violence and injustice. And in the third hospitalization, it hit me that you don't kill yourself, you make revolution. And so because my mother gave me self-esteem, I didn't actually have to develop. I was already ready. I just had to decide. So I decided to be happy all the time as a political act. I decided to serve humanity. And since my aptitude was in medicine and that our country doesn't care about people, I decided that I would make a revolution in medicine and entered medical school in 1967 to use it as a vehicle for social change. I did not have to study very much, and I studied healthcare delivery systems with the idea when I graduated in 71 to make a hospital model that addressed all the problems of healthcare delivery in a single model. It isn't long before somebody looks at health and realizes that medical education is only about the disease care of an individual. I didn't get a single lecture in medical school on health and being healthy, and also that there was no relationship, as I clearly know there is, between the health of the individual and their family and their community, society, and the world. And so pretty much from the age of 18, I've done an extensive study of political systems and economic systems, social, environmental, and educational systems to try to understand how it is that we live in a world with an abundance of food and that anyone dies of starvation, how we've lived in a world where women have never been safe in any country, how we are able to have a population that says it's in a democracy when in fact we never were a democracy, and that our government is owned by wealth. How's that for an introduction?
Amen and amen. We value candor on this show, Pat, so thank you so much for so freely speaking your mind. We love that.
Well, I wanted the listener to get a little bit of a background, partly because the movie didn't care about my political parts. They were only interested in the humor part. People think I'm about being a funny doctor. And I have been silly all my life, every day, for 50 years. But I'm about ending the capitalist system and to make love and generosity our value system.
That's right. That's right. And that is such a powerful currency. And would love to have you tell us a little bit, Pat. Obviously, one of the things that was a changing point in your life were when you were having suicidal thoughts, that you made an empowered choice. And would love to have you speak to, there's a lot of depression in today's world, a lot of things being medicated. Would love to have you speak a little bit about your position on that, especially if we have any listeners who are dealing with depression or suicidal thoughts. What advice would you offer them about turning their life around?
Well, I want them to hear what Freud said in one of his last books, Civilization and Its Discontents, that maybe mental illness is a healthy response to a messed up society. And
wow,
that's very clear to me. I think that, one of the things that irritates my audiences, and I've lectured in 70 countries, is I say depression is never an illness, that it's a pharmaceutical company diagnosis, that depression is a symptom of loneliness, but no company would ever be able to make any money on a pill for loneliness because we know that everybody needs at least one friend. I've asked maybe 30 million people in audiences around the world if there's anything more important than loving, and out of those 30 million, only 10 people thought there were things more important. And yet this most important thing in life isn't taught in 1 hour, K through 12, in the entire education of children, which is why we clearly aren't skilled at loving in our society, that capitalism, market capitalism is the modern version, needs a population that is non-resisting consumers. And for that, they've created a meaningless educational system and television, which is a narcotic that numbs people into, in my mind, this invention of mental illness. There, if you read Robert Whitaker's book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, you can see there is no biochemical basis for schizophrenia or bipolar. Those are just labels that people have, and that it makes sense that if you grow up and realize
very early in your life as a child that you need love and you need tenderness, and yet you are bullied at school. You see on the TV and the news that what we value is power and money, that these are going to create an internal turmoil. Mental health, I consider, a happy, vibrant, exuberant life on an average day. And it's comprised of having friends and being alive. You know, what I did when I left the mental hospital is that I dove into the ocean of gratitude and never found the shore. That to be grateful to be alive, to be thankful for your arms and legs and for whatever connections you have. It's interesting. I've been to the most worst poverty on the planet, and the children there are happier than American children. Because, again, what is sold to young people in this country as things to make you happy, which are things and position, never give happiness. And so, you know, I definitely am with Freud in thinking that mental illness, that if you do not decide to love life, if you decide not to become an activist to change the world, you will have, quote, mental illness. It might interest the audience that no medical school in the world, no psychiatric book or residency teaches mental health. The idea that there actually is a thing called mental health.
Wow.
And if one wants mental health, damn it, go appreciate the wind.
I love that. That's fantastic. Anyone just tuning in, we're here with Dr. Patch Adams. Please visit www.patchadams.org. There's a lot of great resources on there. Patch, I love that you're so outspoken about things. One of the things that you talk about is a system where the patients are treated as friends, which especially relative to the mental health profession that we were just speaking about, that it seems to completely go against our current model of healthcare. Would love to have you speak to us a little bit about what you feel like the current healthcare system is doing right, if anything, and what you would like to see happen, especially in today's society.
You know, I correspond with medical people in 120 countries, and no one has said that they've found a happy hospital. In this country, medicine isn't about health or care. They wouldn't know health or care if they cared about it. It's a vulgar, greedy business. That is the medical system of this country. And that's why doctors are telling their kids not to go into medicine. It's the number one cause of bankruptcy and people losing their houses. And it's just vulgar that there's the idea in the richest country of the world that we don't take care of all of our people and that the people don't rise up in rebellion is an embarrassment. I wonder where the citizens are of this nation, that if they actually studied welfare, they'd see that the rich are the ones receiving the greatest welfare. Read a book, Take the Rich Off Welfare or Grand Theft Pentagon, and you can get a clear sense that the people that are, quote, on welfare, that organizations like Fox News bitch about, that they're getting pennies while the giant corporations are getting billions in government handouts and this business of war that the companies so relish because it's so good for business. So, you know, it's interesting. Nowhere in the world are doctors and hospitals able to practice health and care. And that's why at our hospital, everything is free. At our hospital, the whole staff make the same salary. The cleaning person and the surgeon make $300 a month. We want to scare people how cheap our staff works for. And that I never, as a family doctor, disliked a patient enough to give psychiatric medication. We love our patients. The initial interviews with patients are 3 or 4 hours long. And we refuse to carry malpractice insurance. That's why I actually don't have a hospital now. In the 42nd year, when I started in 71, I was sure because there were no other models and the need was great that we would be built by 1975. And no one gave us anything, and so we collected as a commune in 1971, and we moved into a large six-bedroom house and made our home a hospital and did a pilot hospital for 12 years on our principles. And over the course of these 42 years, I'm 0 for 1,800 in foundation grants, even though I only apply to foundations that say they want to address health care delivery issues. And to my knowledge, we're the only hospital in the world addressing the problems of health care delivery in an active model. And so we're having fun being dreamers and saying that health care can be a rich, breathtaking experience instead of being a burnout experience. At the end of the day, you're beat, you've hated working in the hospital, that we have thousands of doctors and nurses applying every year to work for a 50-hour week for $300 a month to live at our hospital as a communal eco-village as soon as we're built. Maybe the listeners will help me build it.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a lot of information on patchadams.org about how people can volunteer and donate and get involved with your model and all the great work that you're doing. So please, listeners, definitely check that out. Again, that's www.patchadams.org. Patch, one of the things that you talk about that's very significant is the idea of bidirectional care and that it being important for both the giver and the receiver. Would love to have you share a little bit with our listening audience, what is your definition of bidirectional care and why is that important for both the giver and the receiver?
Well, I mean, if we use Mother Teresa as an example, people always talk about Mother Teresa and how she's helped the dying of Calcutta. But no one talks about how the dying of Calcutta have helped Mother Teresa.
You're absolutely right.
And
that's an excellent
point. And what is, you know, some of the most beautiful care I've seen in my 46 years in medicine is when you find a person, usually a parent, and whether it's a person taking care of their parent with Alzheimer's or their child with cystic fibrosis or any way, the person they're caring for needs round-the-clock care, and you can meet them, and it does burn out and really hurt a lot of people, but there are those people you can meet that are invigorated by the giving, that because they get to take care of their parent or their child, and they have that beautiful dance between themselves of the romance of life and the sweetness that comes of it. And this is what we mean by bidirectional. The idea that a nurse or doctor is burned out at the end of the day is a bunch of crap. Now, I understand it in the system that we have, but the truth is you have an opportunity with every human interaction to take juice from it. You can walk down the street and instead of bitching and moaning about poor me and my life and all your worries, you can look up, connect with people and their eyes and sing out on the streets. And if you take the energy given back to you, it electrifies you. So I've led over 150 clown trips around the world to war zones and refugee camps and the worst of human suffering. And the truth is, at the end of the day, we are invigorated. It is such a privilege to work for love that we're not taught it. We're taught that it's supposed to be draining, or if you're around a bunch of horror, that you're supposed to be depressed by it. When the truth is that in the movie or the theater musical version of Les Miserables by Victor Hugo, there's a song that the key line, and I think for the whole play, is to love another person is to see the face of God.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a religious person, never believed in God for a moment in my life, but I know that what they mean by that is if one is in love with their partner, their children, with their God, with trees, with art, that if you are in love, that is a description of all the electricity that's pouring at you from the love that you're experiencing in life. And when you go into the room of a sick person and you change their diaper, and you massage their feet, and you are tender with their family. One opportunity that one can take is to be invigorated by the experience.
One of the things that comes to mind when you're talking about this definition of love, Pat, is that there's this idea of unconditional love, and then there's this idea of conditional love, which I think that we see a lot of in society, which is like, well, I love you because you are XYZ for me. You're kind to me, or you're nice to me, or you know, it's this idea of loving someone to get something versus to give something. And I love that you're talking about this idea of authentic, unconditional love, where going into the situation that the giving is the joy in and of itself, knowing that you're blessing someone, knowing that you're touching someone, knowing that you're helping them move forward in their life. Talk to us a little bit more about your definition of love and how people can apply that in their own lives, how they can take what you're doing and apply it in their own lives to go be a blessing or even help someone heal.
Well, of course, in my sense of what love is, there's no such thing as conditional love. But love is the name for the breathtaking experience of receiving the world.
I love that definition.
So that one can, you know, of course, easy things if you're in a romance is that this person is directing their love to you and you receive it. If you haven't been damaged a lot, because a lot of people are offered love and they don't receive it. I mean, it's one of the amazing things is that I think a huge amount of love, anytime somebody looks at you, you're on a subway and you look up and you see somebody's face and some spark puts a smile on both of your faces, it can ricochet off you or just go, oh yeah, I'm standing there smiling. In the same way people go, oh yeah, flowers, or oh, look at that bird flying, and oh, Shakespeare, yeah, it's good to be or not to be. That people, that I believe, and television I think is the worst invention of the 20th century, that people, I think, live paralyzed by boredom, loneliness, and fear. That the idea, I mean, it's funny, actually, that anyone would inject any negativity in the experience of loving. This idea of conditional love or, you know, half love or whatever, however anyone wants to look at it, it's love is the just electrifying experience of other. Mm-hmm. It's just a name for this thing that it's almost funny to try to name it because it's so uncorralable that when you see a healthy mom hold their first baby and you see all the electricity between them, and it's so easy to see the bidirectionality there, because why is this little mass of protoplasm that basically goes to the bathroom and sucks a breast, why can you, I mean, I once wrote an article for a book on fathering, how is it that you can hold this newborn child in your lap and for hours stare at it? And if there's ever a clear description of what bidirectional is, of course, the mother's working really hard. She's changing the diaper and attending to every need of the child. And what is the child giving her? And yet you can see a quality of transcendence. And again, an undamaged mother, rich or poor, none of it matters. I see it everywhere I go. And maybe 15% of fathers ever allow themselves that, because, of course, we men, which is why I didn't even like anything about what I saw being a man was in growing up, that a man is not supposed to surrender to that overwhelming ecstasy of incoming.
Right. Right. We have very definitive rules, I think, for men and women in society of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And I think that that conditions people in terms of how they respond. And even going back to what you were saying about this idea of love, I think that that sometimes people come from maybe dysfunctional backgrounds, and so maybe their first experience of love was rejection by a parent, and so then they take that into the world, and so I think that it causes all sorts of issues, and that's some of what we're seeing in today's society.
I think that's why God is a good idea. Okay, I had love from my mother, so I actually never needed to seek love from some other place. But if you didn't get love from your parents and you're feeling alone in the world, I mean, the beautiful language, it doesn't matter what religion. You know, I have several thousand books on the spiritual world, and they all say beautiful things of compassion and care, and God loves you, and you don't have to do anything for God. I mean, it's such a wonderful invention to cover if somehow you didn't get it from your parents. And if the school doesn't teach you to, and your own experience of life doesn't teach you to just be wildly in love with all of nature and wildly in love with all of the arts, I mean, dancing alone should be enough reason to live. And that there's so many rich experiences, and yet our society wants you to think rich is buying another thing and having a thing that's more valuable than your neighbor has so that you can feel somehow empowered over them.
And that's very true. That's very true. And I think that speaks to the heart of the matter. You know, so much of what's happening now is people are learning the lesson, whether they want to or not, of what's really valuable with the change in the economy and real estate and everything that's been shifting in the last couple of years. People worked for, you know, their whole lives to amass wealth and several homes and several vehicles, and that has been slipping away for some people, and I think it's caused them to reevaluate what is important in life.
Well, and if I can give a hint to people, the greatest, most intelligent thing I did for my life was to decide to be communal. It's the only way we can do a hospital at 10% of the cost. The communal nature of our clown trips around the world and the idea. Let me just give people an example, okay? In the United States, a family of might pay, it's not too much, $14,000 a year in life insurance to a company that doesn't like them. In fact, they don't want to help them at all.
Right.
And they throw away that $14,000, and they really like that they're not even using any of it. And the company gets $14,000. It's almost like a scam. And then if you do that 20 years and you never use it, you've given them you've given them $300,000. And then if you don't make your payment for a month and you get sick, you lose it. And that's what people throwing away their insurance. If you took a community of 10,000 families that are putting that $14,000 in this horrible company, if they gave it to themselves, that's $140 million in the first year, which happens to be the amount of money I need to build and endow a hospital. So in the first year of taking care of yourself and working collectively, you have a free hospital that is endowed. And that's collectivity. Let me give another example. Let's say you're in a high-rise building in a city that the rent, 200-unit high-rise building. If you're paying, let's say, $1,000 a month rent, and that's to a company that owns a building, and the trick is, if those same 200 units decided to buy the building, the monthly payment drops to about $400 a month. And then if you then decide to make the lower third of the apartment buildings offices, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, and dentists, and mechanics, and all of that, and then the middle third collective space like a theater and a basketball court and whatever, sewing circles and crafts, and the top third bedrooms, then because you don't have to drive to work, you eliminate two-thirds of the cars, and you have a car pool, so that if you need a car, you sign up for the car. And all around the high-rise buildings are these gardens and mutual care. You know, I hope I scare people with what I'm saying, because you could have two dentists, and since you wouldn't need very much money, one dentist can work every other day and have half the year off. That this is what communal living together, tribal life is about.
It's interesting, Patch, because as you're saying that, the discrepancy, I guess, between that idea and the way that we live socially today, there's such a vast difference. And it seems like we live in a society where we almost value or even reward this idea of isolation or personal space.
Well, that's the trick of the capitalist system, okay? What is the ideal citizen in a capitalist system is one who lives alone, owns a house, has a very large environmental footprint, and has to buy all these things for themselves. And that if everyone does that, that's the maximum, then you sell the maximum numbers of TVs and the maximum numbers of cars and lawnmowers and toasters. And that, you know, it was the dumbest move in anthropology history when we went from tribal life, which is 80 to 100 million years old, if you count us as primates, to where in less than 200 years we become nuclear families. And nowhere in the world is nuclear families successful. Sure, we all know a couple of happy marriages, but none of us know a lot. And certainly not the majority of the couples we know are vibrant couples. That we, it's not a natural state for us to be nuclear families. That we wouldn't need nursing homes if we lived as a tribe. We would we could homeschool our kids, and we could have a level of fantasy. And you know, if you had 10 families living together, five of them could lose their job. And the other five could all take care of it. That there'd be no economic panic. That these huge houses that we're building that look like palaces for one family, it's a capitalist system trick. You know, my house is bigger than your house, and, you know, my 10,000 square feet means that I'm a more successful person. When the only real success is your relationship to yourself and your friends. Are they loving? Are you enriched by your human connections? And quite frankly, I see that deeper in poor countries than in rich countries.
You know, Patch, one of the things that really moves me is I remember when everything happened in Haiti, and people who were delivering supplies said that flying into Haiti, they could hear the Haitians, especially the children, singing. And they were singing songs of praise. I mean, here they are, devastated, had lost limbs, had lost family members, had lost almost everything. And they were interviewed, and they said that the singing was so loud that they could hear it as they were bringing the planes into land. And they were interviewing some of the people, and the level of gratitude was profound. That rather than looking at what they had lost, they looked at what they still had, what had been spared. And it was such a discrepancy from what we have in America. And would you say that the reason for that discrepancy is you feel solely based on capitalism, or do you feel that there's something else that's contributing to that?
Well, capitalism is just an umbrella. We were in Haiti right after the earthquake ourselves, and I made comments and have lectured how not the men, but the women, we found it in Sri Lanka right after the tsunami hit there, and that is they were instantly ready to sing and dance. Mm-hmm. Where if I take the same group of clowns to a fancy shopping mall, we are threatened arrest and thrown out within an hour.
Wow.
That people aren't singing and dancing and celebrating. They're going, why are you here?
Right.
So, in okay, if we, you know, why is it so clear to me that that market capitalism, and let me give a quote in case most people don't know what capitalism is. It's not money. It's not business. It's the definition of capitalism is that excess money is there to make more money. And if you take a direct quote from the father of market capitalism, Milton Friedman of the Chicago School, he said, few trends could so thoroughly undermine the very foundations of our free society as the acceptance by corporate officials of any social responsibility except to make as much money for their shareholders as possible. So, whether you're looking at the massive destruction of the environment, the irresponsible refusal to accept the nightmare of global warming and all of its consequences, if you realize that internet sex is a $100 billion a year industry, that 20 to 50 million men a day have sex with a child in sexual slavery, that 30,000 children die a day of starvation, and the list goes on and on and on and on, that you can see that if, in my interpretation of history, for 5,000 years we've had a value system nested in money and power over. And that's why no political system has ever worked, because the value system is money and power over. That value system is, I think, helps explain all of the problems of, so that if I'm in the ghetto and I'm and my single mom is working two jobs and just weeping because she can't buy shoes for her kids, and somebody there says, look, I'll give you $50 to carry this bag over there and give it to that person, I'm doing it.
Right.
And that the so that we can, you heard me say that the three things that concern me most about our society is boredom, loneliness, and fear. The idea that anyone is lonely on a planet of 7 billion people means they have no skills at human relations, because you have 7 billion possibilities.
Right.
And the idea of fear is directly related, from what I can see, to the loss of community. If you look at any of the communal animals, whether it's gorillas or chimpanzees or meerkats or horses or whatever it is, animals that live together, that they feel secure together. That if they separate, they get really nervous.
Hmm.
And that's us. We are frightened because we don't know everybody's on our team.
I love that idea, because I think that's such an important concept, because we all forget that. I think because people are I, me, and that we have a system that's designed around that.
Right. And so all stress, all problems benefit the capitalist system, which is why all the psychiatric medicines are multi-billion dollar a year industries. And liquor and cigarettes and et cetera, because the real meaning in life is the love we share and the generosity we give. And that's not taught. And it's not a value. No one gets that message from television. And, I mean, even if you look at religion nowadays, that the Southern Poverty Law Center just listed the 30 most dangerous hate leaders in the country. 5 of them were priests.
Wow.
And that you can just see them. This one hates that one, and we've got bombing abortion clinics. And, you know, I'm sorry, Christ doesn't bomb an abortion clinic. And Bush called himself a Christian, and he murdered 2 million Iraqi people from the embargo and the war there. So we didn't bring up this idea of boredom. How can anyone, I mean, if you have had a stroke and sit in a chair and no one's paying you any attention, maybe boredom is possible. But how is it possible to be bored if you can watch birds flying. You know, what is it about the television and our meaningless educational system that has destroyed one's thinking so much that their mind isn't rich with millions of things? It's just inconceivable. I don't have any idea what boredom is, but I sure know it's dangerous.
I think that's so true. I'm with you, Pat, especially when we live today that we have so many resources available to us at any given time that it's just a foreign concept. And how much, obviously there's a lot of social conditioning that happens, I think, to the point sometimes, Pat, that we don't even realize that we're conditioned because we're so used to living in the society that in which we're living. I remember having international friends in school that had said to me that Americans have no idea how blessed they are and what a wealthy country it is, and you know, they're obviously coming in from another country. What can people do to start to become more aware of the beliefs that they have, maybe that are conditioned, or the way that they're living their lives that are maybe contributing to boredom and fear and loneliness and depression, and now all of a sudden they're on psychiatric medication and even that's not helping? What can people do to begin becoming more aware? Because I think sometimes it's so conditioned they don't even realize that they have a choice. They think, oh, that's just the way that it is.
You know, I think thinking was an evolutionary device to help make healthy community. In the same way that we have an opposable thumb and that we walk upright, that evolution for a group animal like ourselves evolved love, evolved thinking as instruments to make for healthy community. I think actually, less than 10% of the adults of this country ever think. That what I mean by thinking, they never do it. They still have a brain, but it is a robotic brain. That's what we're so far away from thinking in this country that we have to add the word critical thinking. Thinking is critical, and that, you know, essential is that people turn off their TV and collect with friends and get really good at friendship and sharing and start studying, so that if you don't want to know the fake United States, read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, so you can realize that we're not this romantic country that is the good people that were surprised when 9/11 happened. And that to start studying, to really take a close look at themselves, look in the mirror and say, who am I? What matters to me? Does it matter to me about my hairdo and my tennis shoes and my watch? Is that what matters to me? Or that I know how to enjoy morning? And am I volunteering enough? That there is a world out there where I hope the listeners, if you are suffering at all out there, there is a world for you you cannot imagine. That you don't have to make any more money or be young or be beautiful or have any, you know, half the world lives on less than $2 a day. Half of them on less than $1 a day, that you can, and I think it is a decision. A person decides, as I did, I will love life. They make it an intention. I will be kind. I will never hate again. I will never, you know, I'm never going to hate a religion or hate a country or even hate a person. That I'm, you know, you make a decision. I'm going to be loving. In the same way, unless you're paralyzed, you can make a decision in every second to raise your right hand. I'll raise my right hand. I'll raise my right hand. I'll raise my right hand. And when you make that decision and then you raise it, you act on what you decide. In the same way, you can wake up in the morning and say, I am going to be happy today. And then you pay attention. You have this intention of being happy, and then your job really is to choose which performance of the millions of possible performances in a given moment, which ones you're going to choose in that moment to best put your intentions forward, to be friendly, to be joyful, to be an addition to a particular environment. And then you notice the consequences. If you don't like the consequences, you change your performance. So you would never dare walk down the street grumpy or even with your mind wandering, because you're there on the street with the richness of huge amounts of sensual and human stimulation to bliss out on.
Pat, it's interesting because I think what happens with a lot of people is they get caught up in allowing their feelings to determine the outcome. Well, I don't feel happy, and they look to some sort of stimulation to make them happy. What advice would you offer them? Is it as simple as just saying, okay, I'm choosing to be happy, and I'm only including things that are happy, and I'm not including things that are not happy, and that's the end of it? Is that how people get to that place?
Oh, poor me, poor me.
Yes.
Okay, back to evolution, okay?
Absolutely.
I think all of the emotions are fabulous. I think of the emotions as the sense organs for the mind. So I'm angry that the U.S. is the number one terrorist nation, murdering more people annually than any other country in the world. Okay, now I can just hold on to that anger and shoot people, blow up things, and beat my wife. But the truth is, all the emotions, or I can be saddened when I really, every day I get through the mail and through my study a sense of just how tragic it is there. And I can, and the right emotion is to feel sad over it. The point with thinking is, okay, it goes up to your mind, and it's not to be, oh my God, things are horrible, there's nothing I can do, I don't know, I'm going to slit my wrist. The point is, it goes up there and says, this is wrong. The war is wrong. The fact that we do not feed everybody, that we don't care for everyone, or that we try to hate immigrants or hate this person or call this person wrong, that it goes up to the mind, your anger, your joy, that all of the emotions are there to say, think.
Hmm.
Okay? So you have this feeling, and instead of it being the thing that owns you, it should be the thing that stimulates you to think and act on it. Now, the sadness that comes when a child dies or when somebody you love dies, the right feeling, it's a celebration to mourn. Yes, you're weeping. It's a horrible feeling because our society calls it a horrible feeling. But the truth is, it's a celebration that you love the person. And
oh, I like that.
That the tears water their permanent presence as you notice that, yes, their physical body has died, but they're always with me. So that my mom died decades ago, and she's right here in this conversation. And so the emotions are right. It's just that without thinking, they become a self-indulgence.
And there is the key. Thank you for sharing that, Patch, because I think that that's what's missing for a lot of people. Thank you so much for sharing that. Patch, we have just a few more minutes before we wrap up. What is it ultimately that you would like people, what action step would you like people to take today to help you in your mission to change our healthcare system?
Well, if people think there is a value for a hospital that eliminates 90% of the cost, that shows a really happy staff, a really happy patient and happy families, that shows it as a communal eco-village, and that can show that it is possible, because the reason I've stayed at this project for 42 years and not just quit or decided to do something easier, is that if we can show, you know, the camera comes in, they see the hospital, and the doctors are making the same amount of money as the cleaning person, $300 a month, and why are they so happy? And that they can see that loving human service is what makes you rich. If you like that idea, I need money. You can go to our website, to PayPal, and to donate to us. If you would like to make a large donation, then, you know, contact us, and we can help explain what it is. If you go to our website, patchadams.org/ideas, you can read Susan Parenti's 2 position papers and think, for example, and read mine, and you'll read the most exciting stuff you've ever read on healthcare delivery. And if you look at all the money donated to us in these 42 years, money I personally have made myself has accounted for at least 90% of it.
Wow.
Because almost nobody donates. They love me. They love the movie. But somehow, the movie was supposed to build our hospital and made $500 million, didn't donate anything to us.
Wow.
So I need people, if you want a revolution in medicine, help me. And if you say you have 1 or 2 million listeners, if they each sent $10, we'd be built. So please help.
All right. Definitely for anyone who may just be tuning in with us, we're here with Patch Adams, www.patchadams.org. There's some great information on how you can get more involved with Patch and everything he's doing. Every dollar helps in terms of helping bring his vision to life. And anything great that's been accomplished in this world, that's the way that it happens. It started as an idea, and some people, say, oh, it's crazy or it will never work, and has changed history forever. So we invite you to definitely be part of that. Patch, we have about a minute to go. Any parting thoughts or personal mantras or mottos that you live by that you might feel comfortable sharing with us today?
I think I've really given those. What I want the listener to know is that we have a library here that I've collected of 36,000 books, and nothing I study says that we will survive this century. That we have done such a destructive effort with that. I've read 2,000 books on the environment, that there's not a political government on the planet I respect. We are in huge trouble. And that the reason I am radiantly optimistic is that I don't think it's too late. And so I entreat the listeners, if you have any energy, if you want to be charged to life, let's save humanity and make love our value system. Find a way to teach love in K through 12 like we teach math, 1 hour a day, 5 days a week for 13 years to teach love as an intelligence would be one good start. But it will not happen by hoping and praying. It will happen by action. Be a revolution of loving.
Oh, amen and amen. I love that. My goodness, Pat, we could just keep talking to you all night, and we're just about to wrap up. For anyone just joining us, www.patchadams.org. Pat, just beyond gratitude, thank you so much for sharing your light and your passion and your love with us and your vision and inviting us to be a part of that. And just thank you for staying true to who you are and continuing your journey for all this time. And it's so commendable. And thank you for allowing us to be part of that with you.
Well, it's a privilege to say radical things to people who aren't turning off the radio. And
well,
I if one listener decides to become an activist, it's worth it.
Agreed. Well, you just are a force for good in this world, and thank you so much for sharing your insight and your wisdom with us. You're such a blessing. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us here on YOU Unique, Life Starring You. We certainly do appreciate it.